Hi, I am Kyle.
And I'm Jeremy.
And we are the Social Ninjas.
Hiya!
Jeremy and I both struggled with social anxiety and mental health overall.
Now we both work to improve our own mental health.
And the mental health of others.
By sharing what we did to help our social anxiety.
And what we learn and continue to do to improve upon our own mental health.
What we share is what we learn from our own experiences.
We are not mental health professionals, and what we say should not be used in place of or replacement of medication or your doctor.
Enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Social Ninjas podcast. I am your co-host, Kyle. Join with me as always, Jeremy. What is up, Jeremy?
What's up, Kyle? What's going on? This is Jeremy. Thank you for introducing me.
You're welcome once again. And we also have a very special guest with us today, Sean Callagy. What's going on, Sean?
Hey, Jeremy. Hey, Kyle. Thanks for having me. And thanks, everybody, for listening.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So can you give us just a little background on yourself and kind of what you're doing now?
Sure. So yeah, my name is Sean Callagy, and I stand for in the world is the study of how to create more money in less time with more magic by unlocking the superpower of influence. And this has been the study of my life for the past 23 years. So that's what's happening for me in the world these days.
Cool. I'm just going to jump right into it. How did you get to that magic, and what are some of the most like basic ways to make more money with that magic?
Yeah, so I'm blind. I don't know if you guys know that. So I was a Division I athlete, wannabe professional baseball player. I was captain of the Columbia University baseball team in 1992. First person in my direct family line to go to college. Knew nothing about the way the world worked. Went to an Ivy League school, went to law school, graduated with honors, and neither one of those institutions taught me anything about the way the actual world worked. I thought it was kind of like athletics, like you work hard, you do a good job, and things work out. And it was nothing like that in the real and practical business world. So I won the game of law school, and I got a job at a huge law firm, and I was like, hey, this is like awesome. And you know, I was making no money. Relatively speaking, it was one of the highest paid jobs in my state, New Jersey. But between law school debt and whatever, I'm living in a tiny apartment. I was more broke than before I went to law school in the first place. I'm like, this was definitely not what it was supposed to look like. So, and then people told me a reality that may be obvious to many, was not obvious to me, that people who are able to create relationships, market and sell, those are the people who have a lot more freedom in a capitalist structure. I was like, well, I wish somebody told me that because I would not have gone to law school then. So I was at this crossroads. This is back in 1997. I was going to quit my job, become a high school baseball and football coach and teacher, which seemed a lot more like the magic I'd want in my life. And I felt like I had to choose between money and not having money and being happy. And I was going blind. So it didn't seem like a great option with $100,000 of law school debt and no ability to pay it off, going blind, to stay in that, to pursue what I thought would make me happy. So I began like a study of what influence really was and how it all really worked. And I quit my job, jumped off a cliff. Everybody said I was completely nuts. And because before that and since that, I'd never heard of a person building a 40-person law firm in 2 years out of law school, but that's exactly what happened. And I couldn't believe it. And I wasn't that smart. I wasn't that talented. I'm like, holy God, like this stuff works. And so I became committed to, I sold that first law firm 4 years later, and I became committed to the study of influence and what to do with it to create a lot more freedom and a capitalist structure for people. And yeah, that's where it began.
Wow. And I'm just going to ask, like, how do you gain more influence and make more capital?
Yeah. So there's a science and a formula to it. And there's four steps, 10 indispensable elements, four energies that I have deduced from studying every sales process imaginable and the most successful and persuasive influential people. I have a $250,000 bet out on the internet that nobody's taken me up on, that nobody can out influence me. On a neutral set of facts, I've directly challenged Grant Cardone. My phone is like crickets. And it's rooted in understanding that integrous influence destroys at all times non-integrous influence. And a lot of times when people walk into a space of sales and marketing, they step into an energy of like take, manipulation, concealment, and like that's energetically perceived. If you study the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell, we make split second, nanosecond decisions and conclusions about people, places, and things. And those split second decisions are kind of semi-conscious, right? And so people are understanding like who to believe, not to believe. There's all kinds of dynamics circulating. Footnote, I turned in the largest Ponzi schemer in the history of Florida. There's an MSNBC American Greed episode. That's Scott Rothstein. He took $1 billion off of people with lawyers. And I went down with the former head of white collar crimes for the FBI. This was in the around 2010. And that guy was ready to say yes to give Scott Rothstein money. And I knew in 5 minutes that the entire thing was a fraudulent scheme, even though Scott Rothstein was one of the most prominent people in South Florida at that point. And so it is the dynamics that occur in these ways that I think create and destroy business, create and destroy like countries, create and destroy relationships. And it's something I'm incredibly passionate about. But again, it starts from the premise that, and I also, I mean, this is just a quick footnote. I have two top 100 national jury verdicts. I'm one of only two attorneys in the country. I had 1.2 million to have that between 2014 and 16. In one of the cases, we put somebody in prison. And in both cases, we had overwhelming, impossible odds of getting to the truth, because people would falsely say, like in the legal system, that it's he said, she said, or she said, he said, and there's no way to prove it. And that's just not how it all works. So it begins with the root that like integrous influence wins. So I'll pause there.
So can you take us a little bit further in the power of influence? Could you like give us an example of kind of what that looks like?
Sure, okay. So there's four steps, 10 indispensable elements and four energies of influence, as I've deduced over the years. And the first step is to open up, create a scotoma, right? So like this thus far, like in our interaction, right? We started, it's late, you know, we're like kind of hanging out and it's kind of like, you know, a little bit of fun, what's happening. And you may have like at this juncture, it may be like, is this guy completely nuts, crazy? Is this like not real or not? But at least there's an element of like the possibility that something interesting is here. And you guys are clearly like no nonsense, no BS guys. Like, is that, am I correct in that assumption? That at least there's an interest like, huh, is there something here? Like, are we at least that far? Yes or no?
Yeah.
So that's called a scotoma. A scotoma is a blank spot in our neuropsychology that is created, right, to clear knowingness. Like knowingness is the enemy of influence, because we enter spaces thinking that we know things, right? And the only way that we're able to take what we know and transfer it to somebody else, and then secondarily have them act on it, like that's a whole second separate dynamic, is to first create a blank spot, because before then, we're just like Charlie Brown's teacher who said, wah, 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 right? So we have to create a clearing. Like, so clearing is present, right? Once clearing is present, then we need to create connection, right? To deepen listening and increase liking. Because influence is, as Robert Cialdini in his book Influence so brilliantly proves, that we accept and we act upon the information of people we like. And that's why like integrous and non-integrous influence are quite closely related. Because the very same patterns that confidence scammers, right, Ponzi schemers, frauds, right, that they rely upon, looks, feels, and sounds like all the things we want and desire. That's why it's so dangerous, right? So we have to create liking, just like people who are non-integrous create a degree of liking, right? And then from there, once like liking is in place, the next element is we have to put something at stake for people. So it's like scotoma equals opening of listening, like step one. Step two is the creation of emotional rapport, but not just like some rapport, but like emotional rapport, like a depth of connection. And third is to put something at stake. what something at stake sounds like is like, you know, what if this is actually true we're talking about? And this could be the difference between creating exponential differentials in the amount of relationships you create strategically, intentionally, and how that creates access to client bases and markets that you wouldn't otherwise create, right? Like that's something at stake. You know, the people listening here are probably interested, some of them at least, in making more money, right? In less time, right? With more magic, like easier, integrously, but easier. And so there's something at stake, right? It's like, huh, okay, interesting. And we're going to assess it, but like something has to go at stake. Because if all we do is start throwing benefits and teaching and lessons at people without first opening and listening, without putting something at stake, like a liking being like, or at least remotely present, and putting something at stake, then nothing comes through, right?
I was just curious, is something at stake like getting them to invest somehow, maybe investing emotionally, investing with money or something, or is that different?
Yeah, I would say it's different. Okay. It's having something at risk for them, like inside of them, right? So what a lot of folks do in the principles of influencing is they push, they chase, they have attachment. You can feel it, even if it's integrous, right? So let's say you have a great investment, you know, opportunity or a great marketing strategy or something to sell. The exact opposite of what creates a positive outcome is where we're really, the feeling for the other person receiving our information is attachment. Like we're attached to like pursuing them, chasing them, and no different than a deer. Like people are at a default no of fear of saying yes to things and believing in things, just like a deer is of letting somebody approach, right? And so if we have an energy, an intention of like have to have them say, like this matters to the communicator, the influencer more than the influencee, then we're gonna have a real problem. And the more, even if we have the most brilliant, incredible thing in the world to offer and share, like the person's gonna go, right? What's the opposite of that is putting something integrously at stake. Like, listen, I'm not attached to the outcome. Like I love and care about people, right? This is the energy of it. And I want the best for people, but I am not singularly attached to whether or not you accept what I have to say or not. And what the subconscious and subtle, again, integrous message that sends is like people staying and listening, right? And then what we're doing is putting at stake the risk of them not acting upon a thing. So if you are, like it is an investment opportunity, like non-integrous investment is like, you know, this is gonna go fast, guys, and this investment, boys, is gonna disappear, and it being total BS, right? The opposite is, listen, I'm gonna raise $1 million. I know how to raise $1 million, and I am literally coming to you first because you are a friend and family, and I want you to be involved, right? But it's a pretty efficient conversation because I probably have an hour per conversation. I want to invest that in you. I love and care about you a lot. And let's like have that conversation. And if not, I really think you're going to miss out on an extraordinary opportunity because right? But what's at stake, they realize, is they got to make a decision in about an hour. And if not, then they're going to probably miss out on a pretty unique and special opportunity. And again, the question is it honest or not? But that's putting something at stake. Like there is a definitive window of opportunity that sits here. And what will happen is if you don't say yes, there'll be a negative consequence, right? And it's not saying that I'm compressing this into like nanoseconds. It doesn't sound like you better do this or else, right? Great, of course. But there's a conversation where what becomes present, truly present for the other person is the risk that, hey, like, wow, this could really help my life in a positive way. And if I don't say yes, and the yes could be just to like a longer conversation, right? It could be a yes to watching a video about an opportunity that you're sharing, but there's something that's at stake. It's not, it no longer feels like you're doing a favor for the person who's asking to watch the video or to have the longer meeting. There's mutuality, right? There's mutuality. So, make sense?
Yeah. So I wanted to kind of, I guess, change topics a little bit. You were talking earlier about how you were going blind. So was this like a kind of like a transitional period? Like, kind of explain that story a little bit. What was that like?
Yeah. Yeah. So I have a hereditary degenerative eye disease called retinitis pigmentosa. And my grandfather had it. So I watched him and his blindness in my childhood. And my family knew I had it since the time I was 5 years old. And they didn't tell me until I was 17 and about to go driving, start driving. And I didn't know I had anything wrong. So, you know, I had a little bit of a challenge seeing at night, but it was, you know, pretty imperceptible. And I was, you know, I athletics went real well for me in high school. And, you know, as I was heading towards college, and my family told me when I was 17. And yeah, so it was a consistent period of degeneration. And I only stopped driving. I was like driving just locally up until about 10 years ago, maybe 8 years ago. And so, you know, my entire life, I've been going more and more blind. So I can't see anything on the screen right now. Can't see you guys at all. I can't even see there's a computer screen in front of me. I have a little bit of wide peripheral. You know, I surf, I ski, you know, but I ski auditorily, like with like somebody guiding me saying left, right, you know, that sort of thing, all by feel. And I could see like wide peripheral, but I can't see anything else. So I could see, I can't even see how many fingers I have up, but I could see that there's like movement over here on my right. I can't see any of that in front of me.
Wow. I'm just curious right away, like, how did you deal with that emotionally?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. It was really upsetting and disappointing not to play professional baseball and to get drafted, because that's what I was told was going to happen. And, you know, positive things were happening. But after that, I've just been really grateful throughout my life. You know, I'm grateful that I have a little bit of peripheral vision. I'm grateful that I could see a wave coming. I'm grateful that I can navigate pretty decently in rooms and spaces that I'm familiar with, because I could like turn my head and tell where the edge of a table is or something. So I just sit in gratitude. You know, I got a question, like, what are you guys up to? You know, if you don't mind sharing, like I certainly know who you are and a little bit about what you're doing, but you know, what are you looking to do in the world at this point?
Kyle, you want to go?
Yeah. So, I mean, we both struggled with social anxiety in the past, and ever since then we kind of knew that, hey, you know, while we don't struggle with social anxiety in the same way we used to, we still take a big priority on our own mental health. And so that's what we want to kind of share the message with everyone else, not only what mental health is, but, you know, here's some tools, here's how, you know, we can help you improve upon your own mental health. And then, yeah, just spreading awareness about mental health and kind of destigmatizing it and making it a little bit more of a normal conversation. And I think that's something that's kind of cool about our podcast, because we're two guys talking about mental health. And in my judgment, most guys are a little scared to talk about mental health or talk about emotions, feelings. So, yeah.
Dude, that's amazing. And what would you say was like your biggest breakthrough point, you know, for getting yourself to do this? Like, that's awesome. And thank you for sharing that and that vulnerability.
Absolutely. Do you want to take this, Jeremy, or do you want me to answer?
Yeah, I'll answer. For me, it was just exposure therapy, doing things that scared me over and over again, until I get like, almost like a video game. I get make it to the next level. It scares the crap out of me. I don't want to do it. And then I do something else. Like, I'll interview celebrities, or I'll do free hugs, or I'll do some, you know, coaching online. I'll do some dating coaching. I'll do social coaching. It's always that next thing that scares me. It's like on mission, right? And it was also a combination of exposure therapy and then actually going to the things that caused the trauma, like my oldest brother, you know, treating me like a punching bag, or my bully in middle school, kind of getting the whole grade against me and kind of just really making my life hell. And it was traumatic for my confidence, my self-worth, and my self-love, and on and on and on. Yeah, the podcast is just something we want to do, a kind of a business around the podcast as well, which we're kind of getting started. And then I did like another exposure therapy thing I'm doing recently is a Zoom call with someone in every country in the world, and that's gone really, it's kind of cool, and it turned into a website I just launched. So yeah,
extraordinary, really, and I can't imagine how many people that you are and you're going to impact, and how many people need your courage. So this is awesome, and I understood some of that. I didn't understand some parts of it also, and I am like impacted, and like I am present to that this is needed and wildly unique. So that's awesome, man.
Thank you. Yeah, it means a lot.
Thank you. So yeah. How can I serve or support in any way, like you guys? So I'm happy to. And what else could I share, or you know, what else could I do from here?
Hello, this is Kyle, your favorite co-host of the Social Ninjas podcast. Don't worry, I won't tell Jeremy. I just want to share with you all this really awesome mental health app designed specifically for men. So we all know that mental well-being takes practice, it takes strength, and it takes vulnerability, which for us men is sometimes kind of hard. It's not something that we fix, it's something that we honor, and no man needs to do that alone. That's where the Tether app comes into play. It's an area to practice those skills. With the app, you get access to peer programming, content, and a 24/7 support network where you can support other men and be supported yourself. It's not just a place to come when you're having a bad day. It's for every single day, and we celebrate a lot in the app. It's available on the App Store and Google Play Store for free. All you gotta do is go check it out, go download it. It is the Tether app, and that's T-E-T-H-R. Go download it right now, then come back to the podcast and listen.
Kyle?
Yeah, I was just going to ask kind of if you had some sort of morning routine, or what kind of practices do you do with your mental health? I mean, I've heard you talk about gratitude already, which that seems to be a recurring theme for a lot of the guests that we have on. Do you do any other practices or practice any kind of routine?
I do. You know, I probably, you know, if I, my biggest challenges with what I'll call self-mastery, you know, would be the umbrella I'll put over our mental, emotional challenges, opportunities, you know, all that. I'd say like anger would be a place that I could get to. You know, a lot of the models that I saw growing up, beautiful, you know, loving people in a lot of ways, but like anger was present. It was like kindness, love, but like anger, you know, and it was like either or. And so that could still be a triggering dynamic for me. You know, I grew up as a competitive person, loving athletics. So like that can sit in the space. Like I could, you know, easily get to frustration pretty quick, you know? And for me, a lot of what I do is physiological. So, you know, if I'm putting in long days right now, I'm really committed to the mission of helping people, with the work I'm doing in the world. And these are long days though right now, you know, and doing that. And it's different because I had a lot of years where I coached my kids' sports teams and traveled all over the place. And it was just a lot of fun. It was magical, nonstop, you know, and it was like this perfect flow. And in building this mission, you know, there's a lot of different parts of it, you know? And so for me, I engage my body a lot. You know, if I'm on calls, I'll do planks. I'll do jumping jacks. You know, I'll do bodyweight squats. I'll do a ton of different things to engage my body, to release endorphins. You know, if I get 10 minutes, I'm right by the beach. I'm blessed to be here. I'll jump in the ocean and body surf. If I don't have time to really go surfing, I'll body surf a few waves. Like I'll just do things physically to engage my body. And I found that it's an extraordinary resource. I mean, Tony Robbins introduced me to the concepts of physiology. Before him, it was high school athletics and ways that we, you know, marine, which is engaging the body, I find is such an endless and vast resource to dealing with some of what we're feeling. Like even going into tonight, right? I've been up since 5:30. This is probably the seventh thing I've done speaking today. And I was really honored. I'm thankful, but I'm also like exhausted. And I'm like, dude, I'm like, you know, all right. Like, so there's a mental dynamic of like, all right, I got to do this thing now. Right. And I refuse to show up that way. Just not going to show up that way. So right before I came on here, I did some jumping jacks real quick just to get like endorphins going, you know, and I'll always commit to show up what I call in my body, not in my head, you know? So there's like engagement and yeah. So I'd say physiologically, and then also in terms of like recognizing fear, frustration, and like, oh wow, like that's cute. Like, thank you. Like, I know you're there to protect me. But then realizing how like our nervous system lies to us all the time. It makes us want to quit things. It makes us want to stop things. And so to like become aware and just like observe that emotion and realize that it's just not real. And I have choices of how to reframe that. And emotions that are real, like sadness, you know, like I just took my son to college. It was super emotional. I'm taking my daughter tomorrow. It's her freshman year. And I'm going to be sad. I'm going to experience that. I'm going to process that. And then I'm going to eventually reframe it. And so I'll let myself feel certain things that I think are really healthy. And then I'll kind of make conscious decisions about how long to experience the emotion. So like there's a choice, right? I could feel sad every day. I'm like, wow, I miss my kids being little. I miss surfing together. They're at college. Like, you know, I don't want this to be, you know, even though I'm happy for them, but I'm sad. I miss them. Like, you know, so there's a point that like, you know, missing a nostalgia is really happy and healthy, but we can make conscious choices about how we reframe those things and what we focus on. So I'd say physiology, huge, how we use our body, and then also what we focus on. I'd say we're just like vast access points, I think.
You're speaking my language. the idea of feeling your emotions, and which has been a scary thing for me in the past, and then also framing, and it's like what you pay attention to is the stuff that, you know, gets worked on, in the sense like if you you know choose to think about how much you miss your family and kids and stuff, then you're going to be sad. I like that. It's a balance, definitely a balance.
Cool. Is that something you said that you've obviously been growing in your mastery of and focus on? That's been something you've been up to?
Yes, definitely. I still like fall off every now and then. I'm not a guru, and I think that I don't like this guru mentality that we have in these like self-improvement people. Like, no, they're just human. And I think that like even recently I was in a really awful mood, and I went back to my old ways of just feeling awful and kind of going to my cave. And then I realized, hold on, let me remind myself if I create a space for my sadness and anger, and then say, hey, come on, let's go, come on down. Let me give you a space. Sit on the couch. We want to open up my guest room for you. What's going on? Like, hang out. You know, that's when it got processed and went away, and I felt better. Not when I said, go away, leave me alone. I don't want to be angry or sad.
Yeah, that's awesome, brother. And you know, thank you for sharing that. It's inspirational and it's real. And at 4 o'clock today. Maybe it was this morning, probably about 9 o'clock. I'm like, yeah, I don't want to do any of this. Like, there's all these like cool things happening, things that I think I'm called to do. And I'm like, it's sunny. The waves are amazing. Like, I don't want to do this today. Like, I don't want to do this. Should I be doing this anymore? And like, I probably feel like quitting at this point. The thought comes up like once or twice a day. And everything I've ever done in my entire life, the thought of quitting comes up like consistently. Mm. In, like what we do with it. So I agree with you. There is no like we're over it and we're guru. Like, no way, dude. Like, our nervous system makes us afraid. It makes us fear rejection, failure, makes us want to quit. You know, so I'm like very like heart-centeredly. I've wanted to quit every single thing I've ever done or accomplished. Well, I almost quit college baseball probably 25 times during college baseball. You know, I almost quit baseball after my junior year of high school, you know, and maybe it's something different for other people, but I'm not sure if everyone's quit as much as I do, but like, that's an easy, like, condition reflex for me is like, quit, run away, stop.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean so.
It goes along the lines of one of the things we say. It's a positive commitment over emotions.
Awesome.
Being accountable for your word and being aware of the resistor. And I love what you said about, like, you have the thought, but you choose not to let it run the show. And one of the things that helps me is separating myself from my thoughts. Like, my thoughts do not define me.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, a fun thing that I've done, so I think fun is important, right?
Agreed.
So, yeah, and I'll like come up and go, oh, that's cute. Like, there you are. Like, what's up, pal? Like, oh yeah, good thing.
What's up, resistor?
Yeah, like, cool. Like, hey, how are you? I'm all right. Yeah, I'm gonna put you away now, but thank you. Like, you couch them. You know?
I want to step back, and I'm curious how, if someone wants to gain more influence and make some more money, like, maybe what prevents them from doing that, and how can they build more influence?
Sure. I think the key jump off point is to realize how extraordinary the differences are in people's ability to influence. You know, and my son just started playing chess, and maybe 2 years ago, and he's gotten really into it. And this might be a perfect example. And not one of his friends can beat him. But when he goes online and like he like crushes them, it was unbelievable. And he'll say this, like, but he goes online and he plays somebody, let's say, who's rated as like his computer rating system for chess. I'm not a chess player. I never played, but he is. And, you know, I don't, I'll make up his rating, but let's say he's a 1700, you know, making that up. If he plays a 2000, he'll get destroyed every game and never win a single game, you know? And so like whatever we master is like that, and influence is like that. And so a lot of people, I think, perceive that their influence, similar to like being a chess player or solving a Rubik's Cube or whatever you do, is sort of finite. Like, we kind of get there and then I think people think it's a part of them. So it's like, oh yeah, my influence is just like part of like my personality. Like, not at all. That's like saying your tennis swing is a part of your personality. It's just not true, right? And then second, I think when people get to a certain level, similar to sports or playing instrument or, you know, playing chess, like, they get to a level and think that that's about it. And that's about the time that progress slows down. Like, when progress slows down, most people stop. So some people just never get better at many things. Like, there's many things I'm not, you know, very good at all. Tons, like, right? And so I haven't even engaged. When people engage, they'll often get to a point and they'll stop getting better when it gets hard to notice getting better, when it becomes subtle. You know, like, people be like, oh, I can play tennis and hit the ball over the net. It's like fun. Like, I'm a tennis player, right? And then they'll play somebody better and they'll get a little better. And then they'll sort of stop progressing and thinking they've capped out on how their mastery can rise. And that's just not true. It's just not as fun anymore because they're not making as big of gains. The third category is when people realize, like, there's an endless and fun journey to mastery, even when the gains slow down, right? But it's in that third category, and this is the awareness. So my answer to the question is, first, it takes awareness of this dynamic. It's in the third category, when you're like committed to mastery, that the subtle gains, these micro gains, lead to like exponentially different results. So taking it into like the very practical, you know, for people who want to create monetization of anything, right, there needs to be a demand for the thing, right? And the thing needs to be clearly defined. And then our ability to articulate what that thing is and match the needs of others is like essential. So, you know, in the brief time we have here tonight, it's just the awareness that 1,000 people can try to sell a thing, and 950, because they're in that, those, like, they're not in that third category of like rising mastery, could sell none of it. 40 people might be able to sell like 10 units of it. And by the way, 10 units is infinitely better than zero, because there's no number you can multiply times zero, right, to get to 10. So those 40 people selling 10 units are infinitely better than the other 950 who sold literally nothing, right? But then as you move into that final category of 10 people, it would look something like, you know, a couple of them will be able to sell 20, then some of them will sell like 100, and like maybe one could sell 1,000, and the best could sell 10,000. So it's in these micro distinctions of understanding mastery that it is the beginning of that journey. And then also the other, if you want to get better influence, if I was going to give like a super practical, just become a better listener. Just listen. Like, just listen. And Oprah Winfrey said that the reason she held the microphone for 30,000 people, because through her interactions and really her listening, this is what she said in her final episode, is I see you, I hear you, and what you say matters to me. So the beginning of mastering integrous influence is that you encounter people and leave them feeling that way. Like, I see you, I hear you, and what you say matters to me integrously. By loving people and realizing what a gift that is, because most people are never heard by anybody. Most people are never truly heard. So I'd say that's the beginning.
Just writing that down. I see you, I hear you. What you say means a lot to me. Is that what you said?
Matters to me, yeah. And if you ever, I mean, go watch the last, that's on YouTube, the last 5 minutes of Oprah Winfrey's final episode, and just feel that. And that's what made her a multi-billionaire. And by the way, I'm not equating money to success, because, you know, there's a lot of people who have a lot more money than me. I'm equating our ability to create the money that we want. For some people, that's living on a park bench is enough money for them. For some people, it's an apartment. For some people, a home. For some people, it's two homes. For some people, it's like 7 mega yachts. I'm not judging any of it. It's just our ability to create that sits in the space for influence. And our influence begins with realizing the mastery part, and loving people and the depth of our listening, leaving them to, I see you, I hear you, and what you say matters to me.
I like it. So if you had the ability to send one message to everybody in the world, what would it be?
That loving people always means giving more than you take. That loving people always means giving more than you take. And that's the only way to be truly happy.
Very beautiful, Sean. Thanks, brother. For those who are listening and wanted to hear more about you and what you do and have some access to all your gifts, where can they find you?
Yes, just at unblindedhuddle.com. We're on every morning at 8:30 a.m. Eastern time, exploring integrous influence, what to do with it, and how to create more money in less time with more magic. Unblindedhuddle.com every day, 8:30 a.m. Eastern time.
Sweet. Thank you, Sean. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah. Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it. This is awesome.
Much love.
Much love to you guys. Thank you.